The process of applied functional science is the transformation of the notion into the motion.
From the Gray Institute, this is the Gray Institute podcast. Gray Institute is internationally acclaimed for its innovation, development, mastery, and delivery of applied functional science, AFS. AFS is based on scientific truth, not theory, of how the human body moves in all three planes. AFS allows movement professionals like you to apply the best, most effective, and most efficient movements to any individual based on specific needs and goals. For 40 years through training, education, and mentorship, Gray Institute has equipped over 150,000 professionals with comprehensive knowledge in the principles of applied functional science, AFS. Whether you're physical therapists, personal trainers, athletic trainers, chiropractors, strength and conditioning coaches, physicians, physiotherapists, occupational therapists, osteopaths, physical therapy assistants, or kinesiologists, our goal is to help you become the go-to movement professional.
Welcome to another Gray Institute on-demand webinar. We just are thrilled that you're with us. We're thrilled that you would take time to just continue to learn your craft and to enhance your life, to enhance the lives of others. This webinar, I believe, is going to be fun. I'm going to go zoom in. Nice thing about a video is you can turn me off real quick and get rid of me. You can slow me down. You can come back and listen to me and say, so what did he say? So I'm going to notch it up a little bit, speed it up a little bit, and just kind of have some fun with understanding muscle function. So in applied functional science, our challenge years ago was, here's what we were taught the muscles were doing, here's what we believe they're doing, and there seemed to be a difference between the two. Here's the key, it's context dependent. So when we look at muscle function, the first question we always have to say is, muscle function for what? Because the muscles have this amazing ability to do many different things from many different positions for many different activities. And therefore, it's really critical that we talk about what in the world are we talking about. So early on in my career, a lot of what I learned muscle function was on a table doing manual muscle testing or muscle activation. And I had to know the origin and insertion, and I would put an artificial resistance on some part of the body. Let's say I'm going to put it on the ankle while somebody's laying on their back and just seeing if they can do a straight leg raise and kind of check out the strength of the quadriceps. Okay, so in that case, does the quadriceps extend the knee and help flex the hip? Yes, it does. In that context. So we would say, but what is it doing during walking? What is it doing during running? What is it doing during other activities? So it's very, very important in applied functional science that we say, in what context are we describing it? So many times in applied functional science, somebody will say, well, so what are the hamstrings doing? And we will say, it depends. And you say, depends on what they're doing. And even during what they're doing depends upon the phase of what they're doing. So we're gonna have some fun taking a look at that. Here's the key though. We need to understand that ultimately, these muscles are the things that run things. In other words, this is how we get from point A to point B. This is how we get to hit a ball. This is how we get to hug people. This is how we get to work. This is how we get to play. This is how we get to do everything we enjoy in life. And therefore, it's very critical we have a good understanding of what our muscles are doing when we do these activities, especially if it's our job to create environments to facilitate the desired chain reaction to get the muscles to do the same thing so they can do whatever they want better or with less pain or more effectively and efficiently. Whatever the goal is. And so it's critical that we as applied functional scientists understand how muscles function and realize that within this context, here's what we're going to look at. Now, when we talk about a lot of times non-functional versus functional muscle function, a lot of times we're talking about this is what they're doing the thing, and this is maybe they're laying down on their back or their side or they're sitting on something. So, but again, we have to be really critical and identify that. What is the context? Now, in applied functional science, we have a thing called gaposis. Gaposis is, this is what I want my patient or my client, my athlete, to be able to do better. And when I look at how the muscles are functioning, I realize that I have them doing something over here. Well, the distance between here and here is a gap, and therefore we have gaposis. With most rehab, training, and conditioning, there's a little bit of gaposis. The only thing that's purely functional for the muscles during walking is walking. The only thing that really allows the muscles to do exactly what they should do during jumping is jumping. And so when we're not doing the exact activity in the exact environment with the same things going on, then we all have gaposis. The key is we got to make sure we don't have more gaposis than we think we have. Or in my case, early on in my career, I had gaposis and I didn't know I had gaposis. And so somebody would say, do this test to determine if they could walk. Walking was here. What I was testing was over here. There's zero validity to me saying if they pass this test, they can go do that. So that's huge gaposis. Now, the other key thing that we're kind of realizing is that some muscles, no matter what position it's in, they kind of do the same thing. And therefore, they intuitively and authentically have less gaposis. Some muscles, however, do the opposite. And so in some situations, a muscle will do something, and then in another context, it'll do something not only different, but exactly opposite. So there's huge gaposis there. Therefore, sometimes we have to ask ourselves, okay, do we want even to do that? Let me give you a few examples. One example we use a lot are the hamstrings. So we know the hamstrings kind of start in the butt and they kind of sneak around the lower leg, and we already know that they're a transverse plane muscle, they're a frontal plane muscle. The books describe them as a sagittal plane muscle. People say, well, it's a knee flexor and a hip extender. Well, depends on what context. So when we walk and my foot hits the ground, it actually extends the knee. It doesn't flex the knee. So if I have an environment where I have them sitting, or if I have them laying on their stomach and I have them contract the hamstrings, will the hamstrings flex the knee? Yes. Okay. However, do I want to train the hamstring to do that when I want them to walk better, run better, cut better, prevent an ACL tear, rehab from ACL tear, be able to hit a golf ball better? And the answer is no. Because that gaposis is so huge because it's an opposite effect. And so the hamstrings during gait decelerate rotation of the whole leg, decelerate knee flexion and hip flexion, decelerate the frontal plane motion of adduction of the hip and abduction of the knee and calcaneal eversion. That doesn't sound like creating knee flexion. Therefore, if we did something isokinetic or isotonic, or doesn't matter, and we're having somebody constantly crank their leg back, then we're saying, is that going to help them walk or run? I don't know. My gut instinct is the bigger the gap, the less chance it's going to have to do what we want it to do. There's a lot of other things that we can do with the hamstring to teach it to decelerate knee flexion, not create knee flexion, that's going to allow that person to walk and run better. Again, what context are we talking about? Another example of what we would call opposites, which has a big gap, will stay at the thigh, are the adductors. Now, the adductors are kind of a hidden gem, I think. I don't believe we do a good job, at least I don't, creating 3D mobility of the adductors, and I don't think I train them properly. Here's what I know they don't do in the context of what we're going to call global human movement. Well, that simply means upright movement, lifting boxes up, activities of daily living, walking, reaching, dancing, all the things that we want to do. Compare that to laying down. So if I lay on my side and I put my right foot up on a chair and I take my left leg and I try to make it go towards that foot, does that adductor adduct the hip? Yes, it does. However, if I look at my adductors during something as simple as gait, does it adduct the hip? Absolutely not. In fact, it abducts the hip. Oh, That's that opposite again. Huge gap there. Huge gap between training the adductor to adduct the hip to knowing that the adductor is an abductor. Here's how it happens. When the foot hits the ground, this adductor is lengthened in the sagittal plane. It decelerates hip flexion, okay? It decelerates internal rotation of the leg that's facilitated by the subtalar joint. Therefore, it has this three-dimensional tridoxical ability to decelerate hip adduction. This adductor on this side is really working hard in the frontal plane to decelerate adduction. So this system of adductors decelerates adduction. Just like the hamstring didn't create knee flexion, it decelerates knee flexion. It's opposite. And so we go, okay, I need to know that because I don't want to spend a lot of time over here thinking that I'm going to help them over there. And so that's another example of huge gapposis, what I call opposites. Now, let's stick with the thigh. Quadriceps. If I sit you on a table, if I lay you down, and I have you contract your quadriceps, you're going to have knee extension. The good news is, when I walk, the quadriceps does the same thing. In other words, it does knee extension, but it does it differently. But it's still doing something similar. So now it's not this far away. It creeps over here. So as soon as my foot hits the ground, the quadriceps get turned on eccentrically. The knee starts to go into flexion, internal rotation, abduction, and the quadriceps go. I can decelerate that, and I can, as you come through swing phase, I can help you assist in getting the initiation of knee extension. That's why squats work so well. That's why a lot of things that we do in Iraq are good. That's why lunges are so good, because we're training it to do exactly what it does in the context of real function. That's why if I then put you on a table, or if I put you on a knee extension machine and you did knee extension exercises, I wouldn't say it's way over here like I would with the hamstrings and the adductors. I would say it's here. Still got gapposis, but it's here. Well, that's a little better. I kind of like that. Let's stay at the thigh. Let's look at the tensor fascia lata. So the tensor fascia lata and the glute kind of put together this IT band. My foot hits the ground, decelerates adduction, decelerates internal rotation of the hip, as well as this IT band comes down here and decelerates internal rotation of the lower leg. Interestingly enough, because it's in the front of the instantaneous axis of knee flexion, it decelerates knee flexion, decelerates hip flexion along with the glute. Interesting. And so it has this ability to what we call decelerate all of this adduction, flexion, and internal rotation, and it's going to accelerate the opposite. We'll find out it's going to do it, however, eccentrically. Oh, that might be a new word for everybody. Let's put that down on the list here a second. If I get on a table, does that muscle do something similar? Yeah, because when I lay on a table and I lay on my side and I lift my leg up and I even externally rotate it to try to get a little more tensor, it is now an abductor. Okay, great. Now, so it's then an abductor is a decelerator of adduction. So again, the tensor is a little more here. There's gap between what it does with my foot on the ground with gravity ground reaction force that we'll see, but we're not creating huge gapposis if we actually train that lateral hip laying on our side. So what we have to do, at least what I try to do, is in context dependency say, if this is what I want to create the environment to get the muscle to do this to help this person, what's the best thing to do? And then if I do compromise and create a gap, then I want to ask myself, how much gap have I created? And so I have to think about that in everything I do, because in everything except the thing, we got gaposis. Now, here's a big question. So, what turns on a muscle? Now, we know the brain doesn't turn it on. We know we don't, as children, yell at kids to say, now I want you to contract your glute. I want you to contract your VMO. I want you to think about contracting and bringing your shoulders back. Our body has an amazing neurological programming where if I want to reach out to a toy or take a step, our body goes through a neurodevelopmental sequencing of what I call miracles to get to a point where motion turns on proprioceptors and proprioceptors turn on muscles. Now notice we didn't say, and you consciously think about contracting that muscle. And therefore, if we catch ourselves in a situation where we're trying to get them to contract a muscle, first of all, I'll tell you, you're on the wrong track, and you have huge gapposis. You're probably in an artificial position, probably artificially stabilized, and you're missing the whole point. Because if a muscle is not being turned on, our job as applied functional scientists is to say, and so why is that muscle not being turned on by the intent of the body and motion turning on proprioceptors that turn on muscles? That's our job to figure that out. And so that's huge, to understand that it's motion at the joints that create a proprioceptive reaction in the body, the neurological turning on of the switches that then activate the muscles to actually get the muscles to do what they're supposed to do. Therefore, if that's how it really happens, which it is, that's the truth. Our strategy is, let's do the same thing. So a lot of applied functional science is determining what motions we want to facilitate in order to turn on those proprioceptors, and then in order to turn on the muscle in the sequence in all three planes of motion, functioning econcentrically the way we want it to function. So let me give you a real good example. Years ago, we thought patellofemoral problems were a result of a weak VMO, and the VMO wouldn't pull a patella over, and it kept the train on the track wrong. And wow, did we have that wrong? If you haven't heard our talk on the train and the track, I'll give you a hint. If a train's wobbling on the track, it ain't the train's fault, it's the track's fault. However, what we did is we laid people down on their back. We had them contract their VMO, we had them externally rotate, we had them lift their leg up, we actually put electric stim in there and tried to get the VMO to contract and get stronger so it had this ability to pull the patella over. Wow. Just kind of intuitively, that just makes no sense at all. But that's what we were told to do. Here's the question. If my VMO isn't firing at the time it should fire, then we have to ask ourselves, why not? Well, the first question you have to ask yourself, in what context? Well, most of the time we're worried about walking and running with a VMO, going up and down stairs with a VMO. So my VMO, if you asked it, say, what do? Well, I decelerate flexion of the knee and hip. I decelerate ankle dorsiflexion. I decelerate calcaneal eversion. I decelerate abduction of the knee. You can just see that it wants to do that. And I help decelerate adduction of the hip. And I mostly decelerate internal rotation of the lower leg and internal rotation of the femur and the hip in all three planes of motion. And I go, okay. I wish somebody would have told me that, as opposed to that you create knee extension with it kind of externally rotated to pull the patella over. That's a whole different ball game. In other words, what we were taught to do, huge gapposis. Here's what the VMO really does. So our real question is, what motions in the body, subtalar joint, mid-tarsal joint, ankle joint, at the knee, specifically at the hip, even the other hip and the thoracic spine are not there to not allow the leg to go into those motions that would turn on the proprioceptors, that would turn on the VMO. That's what we need to figure out. Once we create those motions, then the motions will turn on the proprioceptors and the proprioceptors will activate the VMO subconsciously. So as soon as you have somebody and you kind of have them laying down and you go, hey, I read this study and a lot of back pain is because people can't activate their transverse abdominis, and therefore I'm going to have you try to flatten your back or fart into a blood pressure cuff or whatever stimulus you give them, back up just a second, go, is there a better way? Or better yet, why is their transverse abdominis not being turned on? Answer, what does the transverse abdominis do during that activity that you're worried about? And therefore you go, well, let's just take something as simple as walking. What does it do? Well, it decelerates, obviously, the pelvis rotating to the opposite leg. It decelerates the rotation of the pelvis in the sagittal plane, and it decelerates the pelvis in the frontal plane. At the same time, it helps lengthen and decelerate the opposite motion of rotation in the thoracic spine, obviously relative extension in the thoracic spine, and obviously relative lateral flexion in the lumbar and thoracic spine. That's different. So you're telling me that the more, especially the transverse abdominis, if I don't have good, what we would call relative rotation with walking, then the right proprioceptors aren't going to be turned on, and those proprioceptors probably won't turn on the transverse abdominis. Is that correct? Yes. So you'd go, well, so I need to work on the foot to get more rotation, both hips to get more rotation, the thoracic spine to get more rotation. Obviously, that's the transverse plane. We know it's complemented by the sagittal and frontal plane. And if I can get that going, would that then create the proprioceptive reaction that would turn on the transverse abdominis subconsciously? Yes. And therefore, if you're doing all that, you're over here working very authentically, very functionally. If you're laying somebody down on their back and having them, their brain consciously think about contracting their transverse abdominis, you're way over there. To a point where you go, well, if you're way over there, is it even worth doing? No, I can guarantee you, that's not worth doing. There's a million and one things we can do during here that'll get us here a lot quicker. That's what we would call a huge gaposis leap of faith. A couple examples. We can give you example over and over again. Hey, in applied functional science, one of those things we talk about are the physical drivers, the physics of it all, gravity and ground reaction force. So in upright function, one of the very first things you have to ask yourself is, what does gravity do that I don't have to get the muscles to do? And the answer to that would be the answer to this question. What is the context? What are they doing? And therefore, I can tell you what gravity is doing to the body. So let's just use a gait as an example. Gait's a great global human movement. If you can figure out gait, I think you can figure out just about anything. And so the question is, what does gravity do to create motion to turn on proprioceptors to turn on muscles? So if the gravity does it, I'm going to not spend any time doing it myself. So in gait, gravity creates this thing called calcaneal eversion. It creates an unlocking of the metatarsal joint of inversion, abduction, and dorsiflexion. And it also creates this thing called knee abduction and knee flexion. Oh, there's knee flexion created by gravity, obviously, and knee internal rotation. It also creates hip adduction that we talked about, hip flexion, and of course, hip internal rotation. So if you say, well, I'm going to design a program to create, have muscles create those motions for gait, you're way over there. Because gravity will do it for you time and time and time again. Not only gravity, of course, but the opposite reactive force of ground reaction force. What gravity then does is creates the motion that turns on the proprioceptors, that turns on the muscles to decelerate the motion that's just created by gravity, because if it doesn't do that, you're going to fall on your nose. Ah, okay. Makes more sense. So I need to let gravity do its thing in all three planes of motion at those joints for that particular activity to turn on the proprioceptors to get the muscles activated the way it will authentically. Yes, you're playing over here now. You're playing in what we call the functional realm. As soon as you go over here and have a muscle bend the knee, a muscle flex the hip, a muscle evert the heel, you're missing it. We were taught that the peroneus longus everts the subtalar joint. Well, on a table it does. However, as soon as the foot hits the ground, it does the opposite. It's way, way over here. It's just like, exactly like our hamstring and our adductor. It's a huge gaposis, so we have to be wiser. We have to really understand our chain reaction biomechanics and our applied functional science principles, strategies, and techniques in order to say, no. If I want to get this person back to function, that's our goal. Let's play in the functional realm. And if I'm over here, do I know I'm over here? And how much gap do I have? And do I want to have that much gap? And that's good questions to ask. And so we need to understand what gravity's doing all the time. Now, another one that we really missed, especially when we lay somebody down or sit somebody down, is the fact that we're missing mass and momentum. As soon as we miss mass and momentum, we miss everything. Years ago, we made the comment, Dr. Dave Tiberi and I made the comment, that the function of the calf is to keep your nose out of other people's business. Here's what we meant to say in chain reaction. And you can try this yourself. Just stand on one leg, stay up upright, take your nose and put it in somebody else's business. In other words, take it sagittal plane, take it transverse plane here, and then take it a little frontal plane. And if you do that, just kind of stay upright. Don't let the hip get involved, so you can't use the hamstring and the glute on this one. And you kind of go forward, you're going to realize that the muscle that's going to fatigue is your calf muscle. And you're saying, so is my calf muscle, by my nose going forward, by gravity, by my body letting gravity drive me forward, and then what muscle then decelerates that? A lot of muscles, but the primary one are the calf muscles. So is the calf functioning to decelerate that anterior momentum of the body? Yes. That's why we see muscles doing some amazing things at joints it doesn't even cross. So you know in applied functional science, in the context of gait, the main knee extensors are the soleus, posterior tib, and peroneus longus. Wait a minute. If I lay somebody on a table, can the soleus, can the posterior tib, and can the peroneus longus extend the knee? Absolutely not. Impossible. They don't cross the knee, so they can't do it. Well, why, how in the world do they do it in function? Because we have a body that's in space moving, and that mass and momentum combined with what the muscle's doing creates the motion at the joints as driven by other motion and the proprioceptors. So, quickly, if you're the right calf, my foot hits the ground, I initially feel and sense the motion of eversion, proprioceptors are turned on, let's slow that down, the soleus says. I immediately feel ankle dorsiflexion, oh, let's slow that down. I feel internal rotation because when the subtalar joint everts, it internally rotates the lower leg. Soleus grabs that leg and say, let's slow that down. And so it slows it down. But when this leg comes through, now all of a sudden, the calf feels huge dorsiflexion. It's eccentrically decelerating dorsiflexion of this ankle and at the same time concentrically inverting the heel and externally rotating the lower leg. But here's the beautiful part. It's creating knee extension, and we now know it also helps create hip extension. So, whoa, time out. So the soleus can talk to the thoracic spine, but even in gait, it talks directly to the knee and the hip by creating extension, by decelerating that motion and accelerating the other two motions, the frontal plane and transverse plane motion, but it uses the mass and momentum of the body. If the body's not moving and I try to get it to do that, it ain't gonna do that. So one of the best environments we can use is to understand how to get the body moving to turn on the right proprioceptors to create the facilitate the motion of the joints to turn on the right proprioceptors to get the muscles to function the way they want to function. So if I lay somebody down and I do some calf exercises and I compare that to what the calf does in gait, here's what it does in gait, context dependent. Way over there is what it does on the table. And so the question is, do you even want to use that? Not unless there's a really good reason. If there's not other things I can do in here, if something's totally contraindicated where I can't do any of that and I have to do that, well, definitely would consider it. But with applied functional science and the power of tweakology, there's a million things we can think that are better to do than go ahead and try to simulate the calf in an off weight bearing position, thinking it's going to do something worthwhile for us while we actually move in walking or running or just reaching out with mass and momentum going. Now here's another fun one, I believe, is early on, back in the early 80s, as we knew that muscles function in three planes of motion, we realized the books that we had didn't reveal that. And so we said, wow, the books reveal what it does in one plane, but it doesn't reveal what it does in the other two planes. A great example is the hamstrings. The hamstrings, we can see, were gifted to kind of start in the middle of the butt, but go around the leg like this. It's a transverse plane dominant muscle. It decelerates this, it accelerates this. It's dominant in the transverse plane. It controls the trunk, it controls the hip, it controls my knee, and obviously controls my foot and my subtalar joint. Very, very important. But if we said, well, let's just play with it and stimulate it and exercise it and create mobility in just the sagittal plane, what are we missing? We're missing a lot. In other words, we're way over here. If we're single plane stretching, single plane strengthening, we're way over here because we're finding out, believe it or not, it's the other two planes of motion that it's not famous for. They're the two most important planes of motion. And when we see that, it does this amazing thing in three planes of motion. And what became even more fascinating is when the muscle is loaded in three planes of motion, and then we're doing our thing, such as walking or running, we're finding out that muscles then function, and we learn this, muscles can function concentrically, eccentrically, or isometrically. In function, they function econcentrically. What'd you just say? They function eccentrically and concentrically at the same time. Can they do that laying on the table? No. Can they do it with gravity? Yes. Can they do it with ground reaction force? Yes. Can they do it with mass and momentum? Yes. Can they do it with authentic drivers of the body? Yes. Can they do it in the context of the activity that we're talking about? That's the point. Yes, it does it in the context of what we're talking about. Let me give you a couple quick examples. The glute is a great example. The glute's kind of an easy one to see. The foot hits the ground. Gravity creates flexion, adduction, internal rotation. This big muscle goes whoa in the transverse plane, whoa in the sagittal plane, whoa in the frontal plane. It gets lengthened eccentrically in all three planes of motion. It's a triadoxical three-plane turn on. In other words, we got this baby turned on. That's kind of good because it's a big glob there and it's going to help us not fall on our nose. And so as it does that, what's interesting is the subtalar joint just created internal rotation that turns it on in the transverse plane. Gravity turns it on in the sagittal flexion. Gravity turns it on in the frontal adduction. But then as I go through swing phase, that muscle goes, well, I was eccentric decelerating hip flexion. Now I'm going concentric to get extension. Beautiful. I was eccentric decelerating hip adduction. I'm going concentric to get hip abduction to get you on your other foot. Beautiful. As that foot comes forward, the glute says, my hip goes through more internal rotation. Oh, really? Yes. You can see it. Pelvis is going faster than the femur, winding the butt up. So you're, wait a minute, winding the butt up, that means the butt muscle is lengthening while it's functioning concentrically in the sagittal and frontal plane. Wait a minute, that's eccentric with concentric. Yes, it is. Doesn't mean that the muscle is lengthening and shortening at the same time. Here's what it means. With mass and momentum, gravity, ground reaction force, and drivers of the body, that all combined, getting this mass and momentum going forward, it has the ability to lengthen in the transverse plane and use that tension, that eccentric length now, to create good extension and good adduction. Is it possible that if I don't have good extension of the hip, which a lot of us don't have, or good abduction and propulsion of the hip, which we don't have, is it possible that the limiting factor is the inability to get into good internal rotation of the hip? In other words, do we need to, on almost anybody, look at the 3D MAPS component of all six motions of the hip, but if more importantly with this one, internal rotation of the hip, because that's what lengthens the muscle, puts tension on the muscle to give it strength in the other two planes of motion? Answer, yes. One muscle we talked about a little bit ago that's confusing for everybody, at least it is for me, peroneus longus. Lay somebody in a table, the manual muscle test is you try to get them to evert their foot. If you want to have fun, try to get somebody to do that. The brain won't be able to do that because they don't do that. It doesn't do that. When it's on the ground, though, it's that muscle on the lateral part. Interestingly enough, it goes underneath the foot, goes underneath the midfoot, and attaches into the base of the first ray. And so what happens is as soon as the foot hits the ground and gravity starts creating calcaneal eversion and relative inversion of the mid-tarsal joint, that peroneus longus gets lengthened. As soon as it starts to get lengthened, we know that's called eccentric. Good rule of thumb and function, most muscles that we can think of want to function eccentric first. Even if I'm lifting something into a cabinet, you'll see, even if it's a lightweight, you'll see me kind of do this, kind of see me do that. I just loaded my opposite side hip, I loaded my trunk, I loaded my shoulder. I don't just work as a robot and lift it up because that's inefficient for me. So all of a sudden that peroneus longus feels that, gets lengthened, and it goes, whoa, I have to decelerate that. The forefoot actually goes through abduction. It decelerates that as well. The body's now coming forward. Now the peroneus longus is getting lengthened in the sagittal plane. Now the other muscles, especially the hip muscles, are helping with external rotation of the leg and inversion of the heel. And now as I get good eccentric lengthening in the peroneus longus, I now have lateral stability of my ankle because now the peroneus longus is not going to let it invert too much. Now it's going to function more as that everter. So it's kind of like, well, that's kind of interesting. Kind of goes from a inverter to an everter. It goes from decelerating dorsiflexion, it decelerates the motions at the mid-tarsal joint, all three. Well, that's fascinating. So is it possible to train the peroneus longus without the foot on the ground? I don't think so. And so as soon as you're over here trying to get it to evert and strengthen, like they taught us years ago in ankle sprains to make the lateral part stable, It was like we knew it didn't work, but we couldn't put our finger on it. Here's how you put your finger on it. It's way over there in the ocean, and it's not even close to what it really does. And so we need to create, first of all, eversion of the foot. We need to create a line locking of the metatarsal joint. We need to create internal rotation of the leg. We need to create ankle dorsiflexion with knee flexion. And then we need to create the mass and momentum coming over, more ankle dorsiflexion to create the stability that all of a sudden now that peroneus longus underneath will actually bring that arch up and create that inversion that we want at the same time creating lateral stability. Is it possible that ankle sprains and a kind of a chronic lateral problem with the ankle is because we don't have good calcaneal eversion? Yes. And therefore, we don't have good inversion of the metatarsal joint and good stimulus of the peroneus longus. Because it wants to get turned on eccentrically and continue to function eccentrically while it then functions concentrically to create inversion and lateral stability of the ankle all at the same time. It's functioning econcentric. Good news, all muscles and function econcentric. That may not be good news for those of us who learn single plane, eccentric, concentric, or isometric function of muscles, but it's good news because if we know how that muscle gets stimulated by the motion that turns on the proprioceptors, that turns on that particular muscle econcentrically, we can concentrate on the motion that is the eccentric component of that, because that's the tension that's going to give us more strength in the other two planes of motion or at other parts of the body, a joint above or a joint below. And if you follow us in Applied Functional Science at the Gray Institute, you're going to learn all the muscles and how they all function econcentric in all forms of function, all forms of context dependent. And the last one, again, a lot of principles with muscles, but the last one is the body's a chain reaction and muscles function throughout the chain. It shouldn't surprise us by now. We should realize that, yeah, the calf can function all the way up to the thoracic spine into the temporomandibular joint. And so when we look at something as simple as the abdominals, we see the abdominals, of course, doing things at the trunk, but my abdominals literally have this ability during gait with this foot forward and here, and the lengthening, eccentric lengthening of my abdominals, when I contract those abdominals concentrically, and this pelvis here comes forward, literally this coming forward of the pelvis is inverting my right heel. And so, is it possible that a foot that hits the ground and we can't get that heel inverted and we can't get that external rotation going, that if that foot and that knee continue in that way, that potentially, let's say in this case, puts the ACL at risk, is it possible that that's really the abdominals that can actually help decelerate that motion that's going to cause the ACL tear through the hip and through the foot that actually would allow through a chain reaction the knee to be safe? Yes. We have a saying in gait, you name a muscle, and one of its jobs is to decelerate eversion of the heel. Because when the heel everts, everything unlocks and everything's turned on. But right prior to heel lift, I want my heel inverting so I have a stable foot to propel off of. I have a hip that has some power in it in all three planes of motion through the iliopsoas, a three-dimensional muscle, functioning econcentrically. And therefore, we really want to make sure that we understand the chain reaction motions of the body, the chain reaction neurological proprioceptive reaction of the entire body, and what we ultimately needed to know is, so what do my abdominals do for the subtalar joint? What do all the muscles do throughout the chain? And you'll see it's a synergistic system, it's an orchestra of music that kind of comes together, and the muscles kind of say, we'll help decelerate all this. We'll help accelerate this while we're still decelerating things eccentrically, functioning econcentrically, functioning through the chain reaction, taking advantage of mass and momentum, taking advantage of gravity, ground reaction force, understanding that it's the motion that turns on the proprioceptors, reducing our gaposis and creating environments where our patients, our clients, and our athletes will just be thrilled. So we just kind of touched the tip of the iceberg. But just kind of want you thinking, but most of the thing I want you to hear is kind of a thank you, 3D thank you from me, that you're even listening to this, trying to understand it. I don't think it's easy. It was easy, origin, insertion, contraction, here's what happens. But that's not what happens. That's way over there. And that's why easy didn't work. We got to get through the complexity to ultimately get to the simplicity. And I really am thrilled that you decided to join us to kind of get a little glimpse of the understanding of the difference between non-functional and functional muscle function. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for joining us here on the Gray Institute podcast. At Gray Institute, our goal is to do one thing the best we can, and that is to help you become the go-to movement professional. If you have a question for future podcasts or questions about anything Gray Institute offers, including education, live or online specializations, or mentorship, please email us at info@grayinstitute.com. Be sure to look for our next podcast coming soon. Have a great day.